Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, hi, Stephen Glover. Welcome to the Press Gazette Journalism Matters podcast.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. Founder of The Independent, columnist for the Daily Mail, and on to talk about your fantastic novel. It's your first novel, is it?
It's my first novel, yeah.
Splash, which consciously or not, or unconsciously, I don't know, seems to me like a sort of sequel to Scoop, updated for the era of clickbait online journalism and the rather more desperate age we live in now compared to the age that War was writing about. I mean, is that a fair description, or what kind of inspired it?
I don't think it was inspired by Scoop. I mean, Scoop's always been one of my favourite novels, although I haven't read it for a long time, actually, until recently after this was finished. Yeah, I guess it's got... I mean, obviously, Scoop is a fantastically funny and brilliant novel, so in a way, it's presumptuous to mention them in the same breath. But I guess that... I mean, one difference is... I was amazed in rereading Scoop, which I actually only reread last week, just how much... how relentlessly War satirises all journalists. It doesn't matter who they are, whether they're upmarket journalists or tabloid journalists. And the satire is relentless. I met the foreign editor, Mr. Salter. He's a guy who says up to point, Lord Copper can't even find Reykjavik on the map. And the foreign correspondents in Africa, where William Boot goes... all either untrustworthy or unpleasant, or there isn't really a decent journalist in the whole of Scoop, and this doesn't stop journalists loving Scoop. Interestingly, but it's not just that the journalists are all in some way unrespectable figures in War's view. It's that the whole process of journalism in War's view seems to be kind of worthless. He wrote happily for the Daily Mail and other newspapers when they paid him well. I don't think he really liked journalism. I don't think he thought that journalism was anything worth defending. And I guess I take a slightly different view.
Yeah, I mean, it's really enjoyable. I think it compares well. It's in a similar sort of vein to Scoop, and I think it compares well when reading it. And it's quite affectionate, isn't it? The journalists are heroes, really, aren't they? Even the kind of rather sadistic deputy editor is kind of like, you know, he's a good journalist anyway.
I mean, he's a pretty unpleasant character. You wouldn't want to get the wrong side of him. And there's a pompous columnist and called Adam Pride, and the hero Sam Blunt is a far from admirable figure. It's quite difficult to like him. You know, he's always drinking and he's a misogynist. But basically, his heart is in the right place, and what he has got in his favour is that he's brave and he wants to find out the truth of things and. Journalism needs people like that.
I mean, to what extent is it kind of inspired by real events, as it were, or real things?
It's certainly not inspired by real events. I mean, it's a kind of fantasy. I mean, it's a kind of caper, which is on kind of, in a way, an unrealistic level, in that sense, like Scoop, I guess. But I think I can honestly say that none of the characters are based upon any single character. That really is the case. As for the newspapers, I mean, they're, for sort of simplicity, for the sake of simplicity, there are only four papers mentioned here, whereas I can't remember how many daily papers there are, 10, 11. So there are only four here. There's the Bugle, where our hero works and around which the action turns. There's the Daily Dazzle, which is a sort of down-market paper. There's the Chronicle, which is a kind of upmarket paper, and there's the Financial Gazette, which kind of speaks for itself. And all those papers, I guess, have a kind of amalgam of other papers in them, but they're not based upon any existing paper.
And how do you sort of find the process of writing a novel after so much journalism, so much factual writing for all these years?
It was odd and strange, I mean, I suppose the strange thing is that it's just the sheer distance of it. I mean, I think it's about 70,000 words, which is what, I guess about sort of 70 columns or something, and you've got to pace yourself differently, and of course you've got to learn an awful lot, and, you know, it didn't just kind of drop out of the sky into the book. It was, you know, it had to be improved and edited and so forth. But you know, I've always been interested in novels, so I guess it wasn't that bizarre.
Mm. So you were still writing the weekly column for the Daily Mail,
yeah,
and monthly media column for the Oldie.
That's right, yeah.
I think you might be the last regular national press media commentator left. I can't think of any else. But Greenslade occasionally writes.
There's Ian Burrell writes a column in I.
Of course, yeah. But there are people who write about the media have become rather an endangered species in the national press.
It's true. They've gone out. Well, it's also Peter Preston in The Observer.
Yeah.
They have kind of gone out of fashion. I mean, I think media commentators, because they inevitably write about other paper, cause editors a lot of grief.
Mm.
And editors get, an editor is responsible for a media columnist, he's going to get criticised by other proprietors and other editors and other columnists, because, you know, if you write a media column, you're bound to criticise somebody at some stage. And editors and proprietors don't necessarily like that. I think that's one factor, which is. I mean, I remember the Roy Greenslade. This is probably largely forgotten, but at some stage back in about 2003, 2004, after Murdoch McClellan became chief executive of the Telegraph, I think he started writing media column for the Telegraph briefly, but it didn't work out. For that reason, that they didn't like the kind of blowback which you get having a media columnist on payroll.
I think you had a similar experience as well, didn't you, at The Spectator with Boris Johnson at one stage?
Yeah, I wrote a media column for The Spectator, I've got a very, very good memory, yeah, for about 9 years, actually. And then, at the end, he wouldn't publish something which I'd written about The Telegraph. And it was only a tiny little item, it was quite innocuous, and the way these things can blow up. And I said, well, if you won't publish it, I'll resign. So I resigned. Probably, you know, in retrospect, stupidly, because The Spectator was a great place to write. But that was the reason. Because The Spectator, of course, then as now, was owned by The Telegraph.
So the book paints a rather, well, not bleak, but fairly realistic portrayal, I'd say, of the current national press, and the fact that the paper the main protagonist works for is about to lose money, it's about to be sold to some Chinese billionaire.
Yeah.
What do you make of the current scene? As somebody who's obviously been in journalism a long time, are you concerned about the future of newspapers and the future of journalism?
Yeah, I am concerned, and it is certainly the book is about a once incredibly successful paper which is struggling in the digital world. I sort of exist on two levels. I have one kind of, I'm generally quite an optimistic person, and, you know, in a ever more complicated world where politicians and people working at the government aren't getting any more honest, you would think you have as much need as ever for a powerful press which can hold people to account and so on. And there's that need there, and the readers want it. It's just a question of the form it will come in, and whether in the digital world, whether the digital will be able to deliver journalism of the kind of quality that we've been used to having for the last, I don't know, 50, 100 years. And obviously the jury's out on that. We know this, that readers have a completely different attitude towards a lot of what they read online. And the idea of the old, you know, one or two daily newspapers which you might take, is that's almost part of history. Well, that's going a bit far, but it's becoming part of history. And then there is a problem about whether the digital newspapers are ever going to be able to generate enough income to support the kind of journalism which traditional newspapers have, and it's not clear that they will. But having said that, you know, somebody will find a way. It's just not possible at the moment for anybody to see where that way is going to be.
So the paper you co-founded, The Independent, lives on,
yeah,
as a website. I mean, what do you make of it now compared to what it was as a newspaper?
Well, I mean, it's actually a very successful website. I think it's something like the 7th or 8th most read newspaper website in the English-speaking world. And it's, I think, more or less doubled its audience since The Independent closed. It's very successful, but it doesn't have an awful lot in common with The Independent, which we launched in 1986. I mean, it hasn't got the foreign correspondence, it hasn't got the kind of detailed home specialist articles which The Independent used to have. It's just a different thing. I mean, I remember when The Independent closed, I remember Brian Cathcart, who's a hacked off character, said that it didn't make any difference, you know, the Independent closing, it was just going into a new sphere, a new form. And that's simply not true. I mean, digital is so different that it must deliver journalism in a different way. And if they were going to be profitable and if they were going to increase their audience, Independent Online had to produce a paper which was going to be very different, not just from The Independent as it was launched in 1986, but The Independent as it was when it closed.
And then obviously it lives on in print form in a way with The Eye. I mean, what do you make of that? It's obviously another quite different thing.
I think The Eye was a brilliant idea when it was launched. It was a very clever idea, although I think it did accelerate the decline in sales of The Independent. There's no doubt about that. It kind of cannibalised some of the sales of The Independent because it had so much of the same content and it was so much cheaper. I think Eye is great, but again, because it is so compressed, It is quite a long way from The Independent as it was originally conceived.
So I was dredging through the Press Gazette archive, and I looked at the something you were involved in 2004, which was this idea that we could launch an upmarket, I think it was upmarket paper called The World.
Yeah,
which was a sort of tabloid, was it like a sort of attempt at Le Monde?
Yeah, well, whether it was going to be a Le Monde type, I mean, the problem with Le Monde is, as The Guardian has found, there are not many, you know, you have to buy presses to print Le Monde, and I think it would have ended up as a tabloid. Actually, we conceived this idea, which in retrospect seems a mad and daft idea, but we conceived it before The Independent and The Times went tabloid, and before the Guardian emerged in the kind of the Berliner or Le Monde shape. We just felt at the time that there was a gap in the market. I felt, you know, with a few friends, and for an upmarket newspaper in a tabloid form, maybe there was. But of course, I mean, even this was, I don't know, 2003, 2004, not that long ago, but the newspaper world has been completely transformed. And if we had raised the money, I mean, we'd actually got quite a long way, but if we had raised the money, I think we can say in retrospect, it would have been pretty hard work to make it succeed. Though, it was predicated on a very low cost base, and there are newspapers. There's one in Rome in Italy, for example, which is surviving on a pretty low circulation. It can be done, but it's more difficult now in the digital world.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Europeans launched, isn't it? And the new Europeans,
yeah.
Which I guess has proved that it is possible to launch a print newspaper even in these straitened times. What do you make of that? I guess it's not something politically you'd have an awful huge amount.
No, it's got a cause. I don't look at it much. I mean, I've certainly seen it, so I can't really make a sensible critique of it. But you can see why it's had a limited success. I don't know what the figures. I don't know what the bottom line is, but you can see because it has a cause, and it's a cause in which some people passionately believe.
So you're involved in the launch of The Independent, which, as its name suggests, was a sort of kickback against the sort of partisan nature, I guess, yeah. Of Fleet Street journalism. So what have you made of the coverage of the national press coverage around the campaign? Because it strikes me this is a time when newspapers do rather kind of lean towards propaganda in a sense, and it's certainly true around Brexit and probably yeah. True around the election campaign as well.
That's true. I mean, but it was ever thus. You know, I don't think that they're any more inclined towards propaganda than they were in previous elections. The difference now is, of course, that the circulation has fallen so much. So the Sun, which was at the time of the 1983 election probably selling around 4 million copies, is now selling whatever it is, 1.7, I guess, 1.8, and that's, as we know, true across the board. The question is whether online papers, whether the Sun online, whether the Mail online, or the Independent online, or the Guardian online, how powerful they are as propaganda vehicles. I suspect they're much less powerful as propaganda, as political vehicles, than their print counterparts, because that's not what they're there to do. I mean, they're not usually about views. And columnists, they're about other things. So I think the press is as biased in one way or the other as it's ever been. It's just it's much less important, and social media is much more important.
I mean, I don't know what you think about it, but it struck me that the Corbyn's got excoriated criticism in nearly all the mainstream newspapers.
Yeah.
But the poll suggests he's kind of got gradually more and more popular over the last sort of 2 months.
That's true, and what is also true is that on the television, which does remain a powerful force, he has been represented since the beginning of the campaign and a bit before in a somewhat different light. I mean, if you talk to Corbynistas, the Corbynistas think that the BBC is biased against them. Just as the Daily Mail thinks that the BBC is biased against the Tories. I mean, they believe in exactly the same way. And actually, I mean, I think to some degree both are true. And that until quite recently, when he was standing to be leader of the Labour Party, and secondly, when he was forced to stand again, I think he got a very bad press on television and on the BBC, and I think that's changed, and the BBC, like everybody else, has been forced to take him more seriously.
And your paper, the Daily Mail, inspires, you know, utter hatred, doesn't it, from the Corbynistas and people on the left, and things like the Enemies of the People,
yes,
front page, and some of the, it was more forthright coverage, which obviously sways towards the right. I mean, how would you respond to that in terms of people that say that the Daily Mail's sort of a propaganda sheet for Theresa May or whatever?
I'd respond by saying it's just one newspaper, and the Daily Mail, like all other papers, its circulation has been declining. I think there are 46 million adults in this country who can vote in the general election, and the Daily Mail readership is about 3.5 million as readership as opposed to its circulation. Mm-hmm. So that's something like, I don't know, it's between 7 and 8%. So between 7 and 8% of the entire adult population reads the Daily Mail. You would think to hear the criticism of the Daily Mail and to read the criticism of the Daily Mail in the left-wing press that the Daily Mail was single-handedly responsible for Brexit, and that the Daily Mail had shaped Brexit, and that without the Daily Mail, Brexit wouldn't have happened. I think that's really pretty unlikely. I think that most Daily Mail readers were probably going to vote Brexit in the first place. So a majority of a minority were almost certainly inclined to vote Brexit. I'm not saying that the Mail didn't make some difference at the margins, but it is accorded by its enemies a much, much bigger role, a much more powerful role that is actually borne out by the facts. And this hatred of the Daily Mail, which you refer to, which is not universal, it's got its supporters and admirers, and it is, I believe, a very good newspaper. But this hatred of the Daily Mail has magnified enormously since Brexit. Gone up by sort of tenfold. I mean, the Daily Mail's never been loved in some left-wing circles. It's now the detestation for the Mail has risen enormously, and I would argue that it is based upon a misconception of the Mail's power.
And I don't know, did you read the recent book about the Mail, Mail Men?
I did read it, yes.
What did you make of that that depiction of that? It was a sort of some people would probably describe it as a hatchet job, but it was fairly critical, wasn't it, of the kind of culture of the paper, this sort of idea that it's...
Yes, I actually thought, I might have actually reviewed it for The Spectator. I didn't think it was a hatchet job, but it was certainly critical of some figures, and it was certainly more critical of the modern Mail than it was, say, of Northcliffe's Mail, because it purported to be a history of the whole Daily Mail. So it wasn't just about the last half was about the Mail since David English took over in 1971. People have tended to read in that what they wanted to, and critics of them. I mean, there have been multiple pieces in various newspapers by people who've just seen seen the confirmation of all the dark things they think about the Mail. I must say, I don't recognise a lot of. The Mail is quite a. It seems to me, from having written the column there. I mean, I'm not on the staff, and I don't go there all the time. But although it's a tough place, and although people do get shouted at, you have to observe that it keeps its staff, and people mm-hmm. stay there, mm-hmm. And they stay there because they, on the whole, well treated, and because they think they're working for a highly professional newspaper which they respect, and that certainly doesn't come across in a lot of the criticisms of the Mail. They talk about, and people don't have to work for the Mail if they think they're not obliged to. But people who work there tend to stay there.
So I should work this out. How long have you been writing your column now for Daya?
God, far too long. Since about 1998, perhaps, yeah.
It strikes me the thing about columnists is quite a lot of journalists have got a few, you know, good columns in them.
Yes.
But it's not many people can, you know, knock them out week in, week out over a sustained period.
Well, of course, you come back to the same column. I mean, you know, but. Yeah, it's true. Stamina is, I suppose, if you're trying to work out what you need as a columnist, I suppose just the ability to go on doing it week in, week out is probably just, you know, just about the most important thing.
And how do you approach it? And how do you sort of go about keeping it fresh and keeping that kind of energy level up and the necessary level of kind of, well, if not outrage, but, you know, enthusiasm, I guess.
Yeah. I just try as hard as I can every time I do it, you know, because if you don't try, if you let your energy levels go down, or if you get bored with it, I mean, the worst possible thing a columnist can ever do is to show boredom with the subject he's writing about, because if he feels bored, then why on earth should readers waste their time reading? And so I think it's very important to keep your energy levels up, to keep your interest up, and not to get complacent. Those are the dangerous things.
And do you get much? I'm not sure whether you're not on social media, or are you on Twitter? I don't know.
No, I don't know Twitter. No.
But do you get much kind of hatred or praise back? I mean, that's the thing that columnists kind of get nowadays, is they get these kind of loony commenters that bombard them with thousands of emails, and if you're on Twitter you get a lot of horrendous abuse.
Well, you get horrendous abuse, which is a totally good reason I'm not doing Twitter. Yeah, you read. I mean, most of my friends who are columnists no longer read, and I no longer read. Well, 9 times out of 10 I no longer read the postings below.
Yeah.
Because one doesn't really learn much from them. I mean, either people say, "What a fantastic column," completely agree with you, or they say, "What a complete and utter arsehole you are," and you know, you can only read so much of that sort of stuff. So I'm not quite sure why newspapers. Well, we're talking obviously about online at the moment. I'm not quite sure why newspapers print that stuff. But I guess, you know, it allows people to let off steam, and they quite often argue amongst themselves. Actually, they're quite often. I hardly ever read them now. But if you look at those postings, quite often the column itself becomes irrelevant, and they start sort of picking off each other and having rows amongst themselves, and the actual column is completely forgotten about.
What about the sort of email feedback? Do you see much of that? Or?
People send emails, but quite infrequently. And, of course, people still send letters, but they're fewer than they used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, not everybody, you know, sends off emails. So, yeah, we still get letters and some emails.
So in the book, sort of bring it back to the book, there's not a huge amount of talk about sort of social media and Twitter. And I guess because the hero is a journalist of a slightly earlier vintage, isn't he? So he's more old school, isn't he? He's got shorthand, and
he deprecates the fact that younger journalists use their iPhones to at press conferences, you know, or when they interview. I don't know if you've got to that bit. When they interview journalists, they don't use shorthand. But he's not that old. I mean, he's in his early 40s, but he's got those skills. The digital world is certainly very much meant to be there. I think that there is some tweeting towards the end. There is some tweeting, but the protagonist, Sam Blunt, the main character, the guy who's good at shorthand, who's an old-fashioned reporter. He's quite good on the computer. He does a lot of research on the computer. He uses his smartphone a lot, but no, he's not into Twitter. It's perfectly true.
And as the title suggests, I guess it's the idea about the romanticism of the splash of the front page is still there, isn't it, for journalists, and even for the kind of cynical older hack who's on his way out, the idea of getting that one last great front page is the thing that drives him and even makes him kind of cut down on his drinking or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, Do you think you could write a sequel, which has the same romanticism about the having the top story on the website, or?
Well, it's not. I mean, the digital world, although, because I read online stuff, obviously, but it's not a world I understand, you know, in the same way, because I've been brought up in the old print world. So although there is quite a lot of the novel which is set in Bugle Online rather than the Daily Bugle. I can't imagine writing a book about it, you know, to be honest, not about the romanticism of online newspapers, but maybe they have it, you know, and I'm just missing something. Maybe somebody else will come along and write a book about how wonderful they are, and it may be that I'm, you know, being stick in the mud and small-c conservative, and that I don't see the joys and strengths and advantages of digital online newspapers as clearly as I should do. I'm perfectly happy to admit that possibility.
And this is all final question, really, which I often ask people. But how do you see the future of the industry now? I mean, sort of, we've not had that many closures, have we? The independent closed, but it kind of lived on in a strange sort of way. So how do you see the future of Fleet Street? Do you see a kind of more positive future, or?
I don't see any newspaper closing imminently. I think there will be closures along the lines. One shouldn't really sort of mention titles, but I think there will be, you know, 5 to 10 years. One or two titles will probably close. I think what we'll see until that happens is the gradual contraction of newspapers. They have fewer and fewer resources and smaller newsrooms, but they keep going. And actually, you know, if you walked out of here and you looked at all the newspapers on outside a newsagent and picked up them, went off and read them for 2 hours in a cafe, you'd think they were pretty good, and they do remarkably well with the resources they've got. But I think if you were to compare them with what they had 25, 30 years ago, if you could make a comparison, you would see the comparison. And obviously, one obvious area where there's a comparison is the decline of foreign news, because foreign news is so expensive. And that's one point I make in the book. You know, that Sam used to be a young sort of farmer, you know, going off to Africa all the time. Now the Daily Bugle can't afford to send him abroad. And he thinks about those days, and he remembers that the Daily Bugle, I can't remember the exact figures I quote, but that 20 years ago or 25 years ago it had 10 foreign correspondents, and 50 years ago it had 20. And that is, of course, true of not just the middle market press, but much of the press, with some exceptions like the FT, who managed to maintain large number of foreign correspondents. But the decline of foreign news is a most extraordinary thing. In a way, I mean, we can see why it's happened, because of lack of resources. But, you know, we're told we live in a more global world, where we should know more about what we're doing, and yet that global world is reported a lot less than it was 50 years ago, when we thought we were much more insular.
Yeah, it's true. People are much more interested in foreign news, aren't they? The American election and the French election, and all the other things that are going on.
Yeah, and of course those big things are covered. I mean, what isn't covered is the sort of second, third rank foreign story. You know, the election in Poland or Portugal or a coup in some African country, which would have, you know, when I joined the Telegraph in 1978, you know, if there was a coup in a former British colony, immediately, you know, people would flood off and report it. But now it could, you know, it could happen and be scarcely noticed.
That's very true. Well, look, thanks very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
I've, you know, thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I hope it's a big success.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.